Russia pushing to destroy Ukrainian military infrastructure, disabling a major airbase on day 11 of the conflict. Ukraine calls NATO weak for rejecting a no-fly zone to confront Russia and pushes for more U.S. support. In a deadly confrontation in occupied Al-Quds, a Palestinian teenager is killed and an Israeli soldier wounded in an attack. I'm Behruz Najafi. Welcome. Now, top story this hour, Russia saying it has disabled a military airbase in western Ukraine with long-range, high-precision weapons. The defense minister says this is part of the strikes meant to destroy Ukraine's military infrastructure. The forces have also disabled a Ukrainian-controlled S-300 missile system and hit 10 aircraft and choppers. Meanwhile, the evacuation of some 400,000 civilians is to resume in the southeastern city of Mariupol under a temporary ceasefire that will last until 9 p.m. local time. An earlier ceasefire was broken Saturday, with each side blaming the other for that. It's the 11th day of the military campaign, and Russia is inching closer to the capital, Kiev, with President Putin warning against any attempt to impose a no-fly zone on Ukraine.
Any country that seeks to impose a no-fly zone will be considered by us to have entered the conflict. Imposing a no-fly zone will have colossal and catastrophic consequences, not only for Europe, but also the whole world.
Now, Putin says Western sanctions are akin to a declaration of war. He stressed that his country aims to defend the Russian-speaking communities in Ukraine through demilitarizing and denazifying the country. Meantime, Ukraine lead negotiator says the talks between Moscow and Kiev to seek a way to end the conflict will resume on Monday. The last round of peace talks between the two failed to yield any result. According to the United Nations, the conflict that began on February 24th has so far claimed 350 civilian lives and wounded 700 more people in Ukraine. The UN says that number of people fleeing Ukraine has topped 1.5 million, making it Europe's fastest growing refugee crisis since the Second World War. Now, the Ukrainian president is asking for more extensive support from the United States in the conflict with Russia. Volodymyr Zelensky says that in his phone conversation with U.S. President Biden, he requested more financial aid as well as the continuation of sanctions on Moscow. According to the White House, Biden says that he's working to raise the costs on Russia. Ukraine's foreign minister also asked his U.S. counterpart for supplies of fighter jets and air defense systems. Dmytro Kuleba is critical of NATO for refusing to impose a no-fly zone, calling it a sign of weakness. Western governments continue to flood Ukraine with arms and funds, with Washington so far promising $10 billion in aid and $350 million in weapons sales. A rally against the Russian-Ukrainian war has been held in Rome. Tens of thousands of people calling for an end to the conflict that could lead to the displacement and suffering of people on a large scale. We have a report.
On Saturday, over 30,000 people staged a rally in the Italian capital against the escalating war between Russia and Ukraine. The initiative was called by trade unions, leftist groups and pro-peace movements as fighting rages on in a number of Ukrainian cities and talks between Kyiv and Moscow have produced very little so far. The protesters chanted slogans for peace and the end of all wars, urging the United Nations to do more to mediate between Russia, Ukraine and all parties related to the ongoing Ukrainian crisis.
Rather than investing in social welfare, labor, health and education systems, in Western countries have been wasting resources on armaments. Today, Russia must be held accountable for the Ukraine crisis.
Anti-war rallies have been held across Italy over the past days. Most of the demonstrations held in Rome, Palermo, Milan and other Italian cities have been in solidarity with Ukraine.
People at the rally have mixed feelings over who should be held accountable for the war in Ukraine. The majority believe there is a shared responsibility upon all the parts involved, from the US and the NATO to Russia's president, Vladimir Putin.
Sicuramente non dobbiamo dimenticarci.
It goes without saying that history must not be forgotten. NATO's expansion towards Eastern Europe is central to this crisis. The parties involved must continue to explore all diplomatic tools in order to have Putin's troops withdrawn. However, let's not forget why the conflict began in the first place.
In Italy, the most recent government update places the number of Ukrainian refugees who have entered the country since the start of the war at about 9,000. According to Ukrainian-Italian associations, up to 800,000-900,000 refugees may reach Italy in the coming weeks. Max Civili, Rome.
France now has a set list of candidates for the presidential election this month, and many voters hoping serious domestic issues will finally begin to be discussed. Now, Islamophobia and war hysteria have dominated discussions so far, instead of record levels of inflation, apathy, and political repression. From Paris, Rami Mazahedi reports.
Waiting until the final moment to register in order to skirt laws on equal media time for election candidates, French President Emmanuel Macron confirmed he will run for re-election. The slate of candidates is now finalized. Macron began his term hailed as the new leader of the free world, but his once-in-a-century repression of the Yellow Vests has many calling him a liberal strongman who enforces rubber bullet liberalism. Macron is leading in the first round and has a comfortable lead in the second round of roughly 60-40 over far-right mainstay Marine Le Pen. The Russian special military operation in Ukraine has given Macron a 5-point increase in the past 2 weeks, and the ending of extremely strict coronavirus rules in mid-March may lead to another increase. However, Western polling agencies have become severely discredited in recent years, with France's largest newspaper refusing to run any of them.
I don't believe the polls, which are all conducted by private companies who deliver the results, which they are paid to deliver. Macron's track record is catastrophic. He's achieved nothing for the average person. It's truly the dictatorship of a total capitalist. France has really reached the bottom.
The campaign hasn't been centered around the incumbent's record, but openly Islamophobic ideas. Despite running third or fourth in the polls, far-right convicted racist Eric Zemmour has been allowed by media executives to set the agenda.
The rise of the extreme right is totally unsupportable. And we have no choice but to confront these ideas of fascism, racism and xenophobia. France must stand up as one and say no. I'm sure that France will. And I'm sure no far-right candidate will reach the second round.
The resulting lack of serious issues appears certain to produce record abstention. Just 52% of France is interested in the vote this year, compared to 78% for the previous election.
3 weeks ago, all of the leading candidates were openly pro-Russian, but France's media has been swept by a wave of war hysteria, which usually benefits the incumbent. However, for many, at least that has pushed Islamophobia off the agenda, at least for now. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
Time now for the news review section. Washington is seeking allies to isolate Moscow in the most unlikely of places. A delegation of senior U.S. officials now in Venezuela for talks with the government of President Nicolas Maduro. The highest-level visit by American officials to Venezuela began on Saturday. According to people familiar with the issue, senior White House and State Department officials are in attendance. So far, one round of talks has been held, but without any agreement. Venezuela is seen by many as a potential alternate source of oil supplies in case the U.S. moves to restrict Russia's energy shipments. But Washington and Caracas are traditional adversaries, and they even broke off diplomatic relations over a number of issues, including Venezuela's 2019 presidential election. The U.S. has placed crippling sanctions on Venezuela. Maduro is an outspoken critic of Washington's policies. A few days ago, he pledged to maintain trade relations with Moscow. Well, that must be such an interesting topic to discuss. So allow me to invite two guests. We'll have Alfred Desailles, former UN Special Rapporteur in Geneva. John White, writer and public analyst, is also joining us from Edinburgh. Welcome, John. Now, Alfred, I mean, what on earth? Venezuela, the U.S. going to Venezuela asking for help? Venezuela is a rogue pariah state. And the U.S. was supporting Juan Guaido and to see a regime change. What's happening there?
It's ironic. And the U.S. will try anything to try to separate Venezuela, another friend of Russia. I mean, I think the effort to isolate Russia is not working. And I think that Venezuela, that has already endured years and years of brutal sanctions, is not going to be seduced by Washington. And we should remember that the situation here is that NATO has an agenda. And NATO's agenda is eastward expansion. That is the source of the problem. Anybody who has read the two Russian proposals of December 2021 realizes that Russia is demanding what any other country would demand, which is its national security, certain assurances. There were broken promises of 1989, 90, and 91. There was a U.S.-supported, EU-supported coup d'etat against the democratically elected government of Ukraine in 2014. There were massive violations of the Minsk agreements by Ukraine and, of course, a direct threat on the lives and welfare of the Russian population of Donetsk and Luhansk. So you have to put this into context. We don't think that Band-Aids will solve the problem. Obviously, we need a comprehensive agreement. As a longtime UN official, I am calling for peace and I'm calling for a negotiation. I think it is the duty of Antonio Guterres to mediate in this affair. But of course, it has to be a quid pro quo. Back in 1962, the Soviets pulled their missiles from Cuba, and the Americans pulled their missiles from Turkey. Here, we need a compromise, meaning Ukraine has to be declared neutral. Okay. Unless there are assurances that Ukraine will not pose an existential danger to Russia, Russia is going to continue this fight. Of course, Russia can give up its idea of denazifying Ukraine. I don't think that is the main issue. The main issue is that you have a coup regime. You have a regime whose democratic credentials are not all that clear, that basically are pawns of the European Union and of the West. And okay. As an American, I mean, I have enormous compassion for these Ukrainians who are basically being used in the geopolitical game being played by NATO and by the United States.
Okay, now, John White, let's go back to the main topic we're discussing. I mean, U.S. turning to Venezuela, an old-time adversary, how desperate should Washington be to, you know, to do such a thing? What's the U.S. agenda?
It's a terribly desperate act on the part of Washington, which along with its European allies, is going all out to place a chokehold on the Russian economy, with particular emphasis on its vast energy sector. But given what Venezuela has suffered under the U.S. in recent years, the grievous sanctions, much like the people of Iran, and also the attempt by the Trump administration, a very serious attempt by the Trump administration to engineer a coup in the country in 2019. I'm actually surprised Nicolas Maduro would even meet with US official under those circumstances without the prior demand of sanctions relief. Of course, Nicolas Maduro runs a country, has turned the country in the interest of his own people, first and foremost, but Russia has been a staunch ally of Venezuela, particularly during those months where there was a possibility of a coup and an attempt was made actually to engineer one and install the US puppet Juan Guaido in Caracas in power. So I don't think that if Hugo Chavez was still in power, that these US officials would be given the time of day. But Nicolas Maduro has said, amid the reports of these meetings, that Venezuela's oil is ready and waiting for anyone who wants to invest in it. So clearly he is erring on the side of pragmatism rather than principle. And if he does do that, then I think Moscow will rightly see this as an act of betrayal and treachery by a country that they stood by when it was in its darkest hour a couple of years ago.
Okay, appreciate your comments. Alfred Desaias, former UN Special Rapporteur in Geneva. John White, writer and political analyst in Edinburgh, for their contribution. Now moving on, there has been another stab and attack in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Quds, with the incident coming to an end with Israeli forces killing a teenage Palestinian. Resistance movement Hamas reacted by heaping praise on what it called the heroic stabbing operation. It said it's a natural response to the crimes of the Israeli occupiers. Now we'll talk to our West Bank correspondent for an update.
Another Palestinian teen was shot dead by the Israeli forces in Al-Quds, in the occupied city of Al-Quds. What happened, according to the Israeli military, that almost a 19-year-old Palestinian, originally from the city of Al-Quds, just before Al-Fajr prayers, arrived at Bab Hutta, north Al-Aqsa Mosque, and tried to stab Israeli soldiers there. Immediately, Israeli officers opened fire, wounding him, and they left him bleeding until he passed away. First, the Israeli military statement claimed that two Israeli officers were wounded during this operation as the Palestinian youth stabbed them. However, later, they said that one Israeli officer was wounded by the stabber and the other was wounded from the shooting by the Israeli officers. However, Palestinian witnesses there said they were heading to the Al-Aqsa Mosque for the Fajr prayers, and they heard Israeli soldiers screaming at the Bab Hutta. They rushed there. They found a Palestinian youth bleeding and the Israeli forces not allowing anyone to rescue his life.
And with that, we come to the end of this broadcast.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
In other words, our capabilities were limited. It was the early days of the revolution, and there were a lot of problems. In such circumstances, Imam turned the war into a tool for power and national and international credibility for a revolutionary nation which was devoid of resources and equipment. The war was planned by the enemies to destroy the revolution, but Imam used the war as a means to strengthen and perpetuate the revolution, and to turn this threat into an opportunity, such as continuity in Imam's policies. I'd like to cite Tabriz as another example. I had met Shahid Bakri before the revolution. A friend from Mashhad who was studying at the University of Tabriz brought the late al-Mahdi Bakri to Mashhad. I saw him there. He was an ordinary student, but Imam turned a university student into a role model, a great figure and a brilliant commander. This was Imam's work. The likes of Mahdi Bakri and Shahid Qasim Soleimani were produced by Imam. It was Imam who created them. Such is the continuation of the revolution. It constantly turns the youth into great personalities and leaders of the revolution.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Therefore, the issue of the continuity of the revolutionary movement, as I said, the 29th of Bahman, was the engine of this revolutionary continuity, is one of the most important and fascinating aspects of our country's life in the present time and in the future. We must always keep this in mind and pursue, think about, act on it. And of course, everyone learned this lesson from Imam. We all learned this from Imam. So, what does continuation of the revolutionary movement mean? I have given examples. But in general, what are the examples of this continuation? Continuation of the revolutionary movement means that we consider the goals of the revolution and keep in sight all the needs of today and tomorrow, the needs of the present and the future that lead us to those goals, and satisfy these needs in whatever way possible. This means the continuation of the revolution.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
EU Foreign Affairs Ministers held yet another emergency meeting on Friday evening in Brussels to take stock of many Ukraine-related issues. The flow of refugees into EU nations was discussed at length. The impact of recently announced Western sanctions on Russia was assessed.
We are not under regime change. The sanctions are not in order to provoke a regime change in Russia.
Borrell says the sanctions are in fact designed to end the deadly conflict. NATO foreign ministers also met on Friday and reaffirmed their stance of not being drawn into the war. They acknowledge the results could be catastrophic. However, NATO allies continue to send thousands of additional troops into eastern parts of the 30-nation alliance.
And we have over 130 jets at high alert and over 200 ships from the high north to the Mediterranean.
Experts say the US is controlling all of the West's next moves, and the decision to supply deadly arms to Ukraine was a mistake.
The Europeans are saying to the Ukrainian, we're not going to send men to fight with you, we're not going to fight by your side, we give you weapons for you to fight. And had that not happened, President Zelensky would have talked to Russia from day one and avoided this war.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken attended all of the key events in Brussels on Friday, focusing on Ukraine.
Unfortunately, tragically, horrifically, this may not be over soon. And so these efforts that we're making together, we have to sustain them.
A number of political commentators are saying this crisis could have been averted if Russia's legitimate security concerns had been listened to. Therefore, they suggest the onus is now on Western leaders to bring about de-escalation as a matter of urgency. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Western media coverage of the conflict in Ukraine has come under the spotlight over what's seen as racist comments by journalists and their guests talking about the crisis affecting the Ukrainian people.
Me, I'm sorry, it's very emotional for me because I see European people with blue eyes and blonde hair being killed, children being killed every day with Putin's missiles and his helicopters and his rockets.
And so, of course, I understand and respect the emotion.
But this isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan, that has seen conflict raging for decades. You know, this is a relatively civilized, relatively European, I have to choose those words carefully too, city where you wouldn't expect that or hope that it's going to happen.
We're not talking here about Syrians fleeing the bombing of the Syrian regime backed by Putin. We're talking about Europeans living in cars that look like ours to save their lives.
People across the world were quick to react to those comments.
I support Ukraine. I'm also upset at Western leaders for being hypocritical when it comes to taking action for Yemen and Palestine. A Ukrainian's life isn't worth any more or less than that of a Palestinian or Yemeni. We are all equal. We must condemn war everywhere. If you support Ukraine but not Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq, if you condemn Russia but not Israel and the U.S., then congratulations, mate, you're on the highest tier of hypocrisy. Where were NATO, the USA, and their people when Israel was killing innocent Palestinian children? It's not Ukraine, it's Gaza, but no one stands for them.
Social media platforms have also been filled with comments criticizing different approaches by European countries in dealing with refugees. The Ukrainians fleeing the conflict in their country have received a warm welcome by their neighbors, including Poland. No problem with that. But these European states had a totally different stance back in 2015, when an influx of refugees escaping poverty and violence in Africa and the Middle East reached Europe. Some European authorities have even drawn a distinct line between the two groups of people.
These are not the refugees we are used to. Ukrainian people are Europeans. These people are intelligent. They are educated people. This is not the refugee wave we have been used to. People we were not sure about their identity. People with unclear pasts who could have been even terrorists.
Race and nationality again become important when people fleeing the Ukraine war are received. There have been reports of Africans being turned away at the border by security forces. Some of the journalists that were caught red-handed ended up apologizing for being, quote, insensitive. But questions remain that whether being a European means the mainstream media will be more likely to talk about their distress. Many may now hope that having darker skin or being from a certain religion doesn't make others ignore their pain and suffering.
It is unusually cold in Italy for early March. Forecasters have predicted freezing weather will hit the country from north to south over the next 10 days. Italians have been told not to worry about low temperatures for now. Their homes will be heated through the winter season.
However, things could be very much different in the coming future. The government, led by Prime Minister Mario Draghi, has recently issued a decree in which, besides introducing a state of emergency over the conflict in Ukraine, it also referred to possible gas rationing following its decision to do without the Russian gas. Italy imports about 95% of its gas, 45% of which is coming from Russia.
Technically, Italy is already in a state of gas supply emergency. There is a plan in place at the Energy Ministry which features three levels of intervention. The country will resort to the maximization of its fossil fuel generated power in the first place. It will take years for Italy to replace Russian gas supplies. In the short term, only about one-third of the gas provided but Moscow can be sourced elsewhere.
In the wake of the Ukraine crisis, Rome is looking to boost gas supplies from other international partners. Italy is paying dearly for not having diversified more its energy sources and its suppliers throughout the years.
In an attempt to reduce Italy's dependence on Russian gas, Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio has recently been to Algeria to discuss ways to increase gas supplies. Algeria is the second supplier of gas to Italy.
Italy held a self-destructive attitude when it came to diversifying its energy sources in the past. We used to have great gas suppliers such as Libya and Iran, but these countries were either thrown into a war or heavily sanctioned in the name of NATO's interests. And for this reason today, we depend very much on Russia's gas.
While the EU is expected to unveil a new energy strategy to reduce its member states' dependency from Moscow's gas, on Friday the Italian Foreign Minister Di Maio warned that if Russia thinks it can blackmail Italy on energy, then they've got their own country. According to some geopolitical experts, European countries must keep into account that Russia would be capable of turning off gas supplies to the old continent. Max Civili, Rome.
A huge number of Ukrainian refugees continue to arrive at EU borders in Poland, Slovakia, Romania and Hungary. On Thursday, EU Home Affairs ministers adopted the Temporary Protection Directive. It means the refugees can work and go to school in any of the bloc's 27 member states for at least 1 year.
If you compare to the refugees that came in 2015, how long time it took to have the proper decisions. For example, just to have their asylum applications processed, it could take years.
So, by the EU's own admission, refugees travelling here from conflict zones involving Western military powers did not and do not receive the same protection. Meanwhile, advocates are calling on the EU to pay particular attention to certain groups.
In general, people who are displaced in a forced way are vulnerable. We want to call attention to specifically the situation of women and girls because they are disproportionately affected.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen travelled to Slovakia and Romania on Thursday to assess the refugee crises facing the two EU nations. She took the opportunity to try and apply additional pressure on Moscow.
The three waves of sanctions we introduced are already having an impact on the Russian economy and therefore Putin's war effort. And we will take additional steps if the situation deteriorates on the ground.
Non-EU country Moldova has taken in more than 100,000 Ukrainian refugees so far. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell visited the country on Thursday to offer support. However, there is concern over the treatment of some who are trying to reach the EU from Ukraine. Senior UN officials are criticising evidence of discrimination by EU border authorities against African and Asian nationals attempting to flee the conflict. Rights groups are also condemning the racism and are asking EU leaders to remember the bloc's values they talk so much about. Jerome Hughes, Press TV, Brussels.
Al-Fajr cultural days have kicked off, but this time it is not held in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Rather, Beirut is hosting the event like many other Iranian art exhibitions held here.
Activities include many art activities, theater, music, exhibition, seminars, and other activities.
The Iranian Minister of Culture opened the festivals with an awe-inspiring musical concert. Iranian musicians there glad to be attending such an event.
I'm a musician from Iran. I play oud, a common instrument in Muslim world. I really like the Arabic culture, Arabic countries' cultures. By myself, and I think the collaboration between Muslim countries, it would be good. Something like Fajr days in Lebanon, and I really enjoy my stay in Lebanon.
The many facets of Iran's artistic culture have come all the way to Lebanon, from the folklore dress to post-Islamic calligraphy.
This exhibition is for Iranian exhibition for the Iranian handicraft for before Islam and after Islam.
According to organizers, this event is significant in that it represents part of collaboration between Iran and Lebanon. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The World Bank has recently approved a plan to use more than $1 billion from a frozen Afghan trust fund for aid in Afghanistan through UN agencies and charities. Afghan experts welcoming the move suggest that there should be a clear mechanism for disbursing the money so that Afghanistan gains the greatest benefits.
Allocating $1 billion as aid is a piece of good news for Afghanistan, but there should be a clear and appropriate mechanism so that the money is not wasted like hundreds of billions of dollars that were poured into Afghanistan in the past 20 years. I think, first of all, the UN should come to an understanding with the Taliban. Then they can assess needs or create jobs through developmental and fundamental projects.
This comes as unemployment, poverty, and hunger crises are deepening in Afghan society. Afghans expect the Taliban and international community to create job opportunities, calling for unfreeze of Afghanistan's frozen funds and more aid to the country.
We have been experiencing a very harsh winter. Many died of hunger and illnesses. We neither have a job nor received humanitarian aid.
Following the Taliban takeover, the U.S. froze some $9 billion in Afghan central bank assets and large global funds to the country were halted. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Turkey has closed the passage of warships through its Straits of Bosphorus and Dardanelles. The decision was taken after Ankara called Russia's military action in Ukraine a war. President Erdogan said Turkey is using the authority given to it by the 1963 Montreux Convention Pact on passage of its straits to prevent the escalation of the Russia and Ukraine conflict.
Turkey is determined to use the authority given by the Montreux Convention on Turkish Straits in a manner to prevent escalation of the Russia-Ukraine crisis.
Erdogan said he was very saddened by Moscow's attack on its neighbor, describing the move as unacceptable, adding that Turkey will not abandon its ties with both Ukraine and Russia. The Turkish defense minister, in his turn, asked all sides to respect the international pact Turkey has worked by, assuring that it is Ankara's right to limit passage in the straits in wartime. Kiev had already asked Turkey to close its straits to the Russian warships. The move will prevent more Russian ships from reaching the Black Sea, from where it had launched attacks on Ukrainian southern coast. Analysts say Turkey's decision does not only help Ukraine but also Russia, as the decision prevents all warships, not only Russian ones, from crossing the straits.
Turkey is following a balanced policy between the two countries. The president already clearly stated that Ankara will not take side and stand with neither Russia nor Ukraine. However, enforcing the Montreux Convention is an international procedure, which will not affect Russia negatively, and Ukraine had already asked for it, hence Turkey will not be put in a position to choose sides. However, Turkey already rejects the Russian military action.
Turkey maintains good ties with both Russia and Ukraine, as it bought S-400 missiles from the first and sold the drones to the second, and does not seem willing to risk taking sides in this conflict. It seems that Turkey is trying to remain impartial in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, while it's trying to mediate to end the fight, with President Erdogan making some calls and pushing for a political solution. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
The Home Office has verified that the majority of people trying to reach the UK's shores via the English Channel are fleeing war and persecution. This comes in response to allegations made by the Home Secretary that the majority are illegitimate, in her own words, asylum shoppers.
If the laws that they're trying to put through Parliament at the present time, if they had been in process at the time that the present Home Secretary, Priti Patel, the time her family came as refugees and asylum seekers from Uganda, they would not have been allowed to come into the United Kingdom. Or if they did come into the United Kingdom, they would be put into some sort of detention camps that she is advocating.
The issue of Ukrainian refugees also got off to a rocky start, with the Home Secretary suggesting they could benefit from fruit picker visas. Now, under pressure, the government is offering emergency visas for those with family members already living in Britain. But at the same time, the government is pushing through legislation that will criminalise those coming from the Middle East and Africa, specifically via the English Channel, and people protesting this are getting mixed responses.
It's interesting that while we've been reporting here today, we have heard people pass by making some pretty off-colour remarks about refugees arriving here in this country. And that just confirms that there is a lack of sympathy here. And some would say those sentiments stem from misinformation, but most importantly, from racism.
White-skinned, blue-eyed. They've said it on the media. White-skinned, blue-eyed means you're acceptable. If you're brown-skinned or black-skinned, you're not acceptable. And it's a form of apartheid.
There are people who have been driven to suicide after arriving in Britain. There were actually more people dying after being in the hands of the Home Office here than the numbers that had been dying crossing the Channel. And that is crazy to think that the hope and the aspiration that drives a person to risk their life, the kind of Britain that they're hoping for, is the one we want to live in. But it's not the one we have. It's what we have is deeply driven, divided by racism.
The Borders and Nationality Bill will give the UK extraordinary powers to criminalise, prosecute and imprison refugees, and give the Coast Guard immunity from prosecution if refugees die at sea. There have been widespread protests demanding this bill be scrapped, specifically now that the government is poised to issue hundreds of thousands of visas for Ukrainians, proving that when there's a will, there's a way. Bianca Rahimi, London.
British ministers have already written to the UK's media regulator, Ofcom, asking it to review RT's licence to broadcast in the country.
In another unprecedented step, we will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik, as well as their subsidiaries, will no longer be able to spread their lies to justify Putin's war and to sow division in our union.
Social media platforms with headquarters in the West could soon follow suit and bar pro-Russian sites and commentators from their platforms.
This unprecedented move by the EU is supposed to combat what it's calling Russian propaganda about the war. But analysts warn that this step will only further highlight the double standards that exist when it comes to the issue of freedom of speech.
The hypocrisy of the move being pushed by the EU is not lost on media commentators.
I think it's blatant censorship. And the European Union and the Western world in general always bangs on about, you know, freedom of speech and democracy. And that's one of the cornerstones of their societies. And this is blatantly censoring opinions they don't like. And it's as simple as that. It's incredibly hypocritical. It's incredibly disappointing. The reaction of Western mainstream media journalists is also incredibly disappointing because a lot of them are cheerleading for this.
With tensions surrounding the Ukraine conflict building, there are questions being raised about the way mainstream Western outlets have been covering this crisis. For some analysts, the move to ban Russian media is part of a strategy to ensure the public has access to only one overriding narrative.
The censoring of media outlets, the sending of arms to Ukraine, these kind of things would not be allowed or accepted by Western public opinions if there wasn't this disinformation campaign and propaganda campaign against Russia, which has been ongoing for many years now.
With the media war almost as important as the physical conflict being waged, the West is very much aware of the significance of stifling Russian voices at this time. But observers are asking, at what cost? Amina Taylor, London.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all around the world, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from a series of Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer doubts and misconceptions from around the world on Islamic issues and Islamic principles. Like always, in our recent shows, we have invited Sheikh Nur Muhammad from Qom Seminary Schools. We'd like to welcome him to this show and say salam to him and inshallah start our discussion with him. Sheikhuna, salam alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. It's a great pleasure for us. The question of the day that we want to talk about it in this very session and ask our respected guest speaker of the show, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, to shed some light on that and inform us about the different aspects of it is about astrology and the prediction of the future by the knowledge of the stars and through the knowledge that some people have from stars and also celestial bodies. It's common among some people that they believe in such things. We want to know if we also are allowed to refer to such people and to take some information from them, because we are also in need of some critical information for our future. I want to know, for example, what to do exactly and what comes to me and what happens to me in my upcoming days and upcoming weeks. So it's very nice and even interesting to know that there is a knowledge, some people have a sort of knowledge that they can predict future and they can look at the star and tell you which one is your own star, and then they will guide you what to do and what will come to you and what will happen to you. So let's ask the basic question that what's the Islamic perspective on the astrology and this sort of prediction? Sheikhna, I should be thankful if you shed some light on that and tell us what is Islamic perspective and such knowledge and that some people are equipped with, that they know that about your future and they look at you and they guess which one is your own star and then they will predict whatever you need. So tell us more about that.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think that we should look at the moments because because what matters is the moment that you leave. I want to say that we should look at our responsibility and what is a best choice that we want to do right now. Mm-hmm. Because the past has been past and the future, of course, did not come yet. Mm-hmm. What matters is right now. And I want to, you know, have the best choice and the best action right now. Mm-hmm. But when you want to have any kind of, you know, prediction for the future, there have been some people, they refer to the, as you mentioned, to the, for example, astrology or celestial bodies, whether these kind of, you know, ideas are acceptable or not.
Yeah.
You see that when, if you believe that this kind of celestial body has some kind of effect on the life of human being, and you want to refute the power and the decisions of Allah and the maintenance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, if you refute that, for sure it is not acceptable, okay? And it is not acceptable to believe that, I want to say that rationally speaking, it is not acceptable to believe that any kind of celestial body, they have some effect on your life.
Yeah.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is maintainer of the universe.
Yeah.
He created this universe and he has all power for, you know, controlling and giving sustenance to the universe and to the human being. It is not acceptable to say that any kind of celestial body or astrology have any kind of effect on the life of the human being. And of course, you cannot do it in a certain way. You cannot say that for sure these celestial bodies, they have some effect on the life of the human being. Maybe some people, they can claim that by some possibilities, okay? Because something is possible or not. But you cannot tell it and express it in certain way. But after all, of the point that I want to make here, and it is a most important thing, that these celestial bodies, they cannot refute the power and the maintenance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is all powerful and all knowing, and he has all control over the, you know, human being and over the universe, because he is Rabbul Alameen. He has created and the all worlds, and he is a, you know, we can say the owner of the these two. He is a owner of all worlds.
Sheikh, what is interesting is that those who claim to have such knowledge, they say that they have gained this knowledge by Allah's power, that they are actually acting upon what Allah has gifted them. So he says that, he or she says that, Allah has gifted me a sort of knowledge that I know what comes to your future. The question is, why Allah himself did not give us this knowledge to know about our future? I mean, directly to ourselves. So Allah gifts it to some certain people. Then is it, again, okay to talk about future events that comes to a person, I mean, while others have no idea of it. So, but again, in a hadith we have that أَبَلَّا أَنْ يَجَلْ أُمْرِ اللَّهِ بِأَسْبَابَ. Allah wants everything to be in its own natural way to happen. So why, how can we actually solve these issues? And if we put different, let's say, parts of this puzzle together, how can we make it a full puzzle?
You see that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has two proof. إِنَّ لِلَّهِ عَلَى النَّاسِ هُجَّتَيْنِ. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, according to the narrations of Imam al-Qadim alayhi salatu wa salam to Hisham,
He said that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has two proof. First of all, your reasoning, the power of reasoning. Second, al-anbiya wal-rusul wal-awsiya, prophets and the successor of the prophets. You see that these are play the role of a proof for the human being. You see that many people, they claim many things. They claim that Allah give me this power, I can protect, your future, I have the power of all things. You know, these are not acceptable, rationally speaking. These are not acceptable. You should have some proof, you should bring some proof for your claims. If not, your proof is refuted.
Okay? Very true.
This is a first answer to the question.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Why Allah hasn't gifted this power, this knowledge to everyone and gave it to some certain people?
Because it has some harm for the normal life of the human being.
Okay.
You see that? Because if, for example, I know that...
So how come it has this harm and, let's say, this badness for some people and it is good for some?
Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted to, you know, keep the normal life of the human being. It is not necessary to know your future. Because if an individual, he knows or she knows that, for example, after a month, that person going to die, he or she lose the normal life of his daily life.
So it is not Allah's custom and habit, or less a sunnah, to inform a person from what comes to him in his future.
Exactly.
Except the awliya of Allah, the highest people in rank and purity, might know that, but they will act like, because they are the materialization of names and attributes of Allah, then they are silent like Allah is.
Of course, even talking about the prophets and awliya, the successor of the prophets, they know they have ilmul ladunni, is kind of God-given knowledge.
True.
But they did not use it in all occasions.
So we can make a conclusion. All those who use them in different occasions, they have no knowledge of it.
Of course, yes, exactly. Those people, for example, I want to refute this idea that those people who claim that we know the future, I have God-given knowledge, or so on and so forth, these are not acceptable.
Yeah.
And these are kind of, you know, mere claims.
Very true.
False claims that has no proof supporting that.
Very true.
For example, if you look at the verses of Noble Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that وَلَا تَقُولَنَّ لِشَيْءٍ إِنِّي فَائِلٌ دَالِكَ قَدًا إِلَّا أَنْ يَشَاءَ اللَّهِ. Do not say for sure I'm going to do that tomorrow, except that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants it. Okay. In this verse of Noble Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted to encourage us to always have kind of reliance or tawakkul to Almighty, not forget the power and the might of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and to always have this kind of reliance to Him. And actually, this is a meaning of the tawakkul or reliance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. For example, we have Hasbunallah wa ni'mal wakil. Allah is sufficient for us and He is a best supporter, you know. Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted to always remember Him and to have kind of connection to Him. But these people who claim to know the future of the human being, because if you have these ideas, first of all, they are false claims. Nobody have kind bring any kind of acceptable proof whether you have this ability or not, because they are proofless and they do not have any proof for that.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, is, you know, defeats the idea of tawakkul and reliance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And after that, it's ruined your normal life.
Very true.
Okay? Yeah. If you supposedly, granted that you know you have this ability, of course we have all doubt about that. But granted, you have this ability, it's, you know, ruined your normal life.
Thank you very much, dear Sheikh. That's true. So we need to pay close attention to this concept that anyone who believes, anyone who claims to have a sort of knowledge of astrology and prediction of the future, so we need to actually look at such issues and such claimers with more care. And we need just to rely and depend on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has written for us and has actually, whatever He has destined for us. So those who have the knowledge of ilm al-laduni, or they have a sort of, let's say, divine knowledge, they're connected to Allah. And they are not the ones who come to you and tell you, for example, what has been written for you in your stars and your